Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Mark Jones, author of 1923, The Forgotten Crisis in the Year of Hitler's Coup, explores how and why Hitler and the Nazis were able to come to power, and how they remained in power for so long. Recorded live at the 2023 Bradford Literature Festival, this discussion considers Hitler's and the Nazis' impact on people's lives and the terrifying lessons that this dark chapter in human history has for the world today.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for joining us. And I hope it's going to be a really interesting discussion. So I'm the chair of the Literature Festival, but this is the person we come here to listen to. And we're going to talk about that book, which you'll all have read, The Irish Independent, this morning. It's reviewed in The Irish Independent, so it's a riveting read, which it is. I couldn't commend it more highly. So this is Mark's second book. His first book was about the Weimar Republic, founding Weimar. It was called Violence and the German Revolution of 1918-19. The plan is that he's going to talk for 10 minutes or so, then he and I will have a discussion, and then we'll throw it over to you for comments and queries and suggestions. But before I give it to Mark, you seem to have a bit of a thing about violent stories in Germany. Could you tell us a bit about yourself?
So first of all, hello everybody, and it's great to be here, and it's great to have flown over last night, and it's my first time in Bradford, and I'm delighted and really enjoying the stay here, and thank you all for coming. Thinking about, I suppose, what we might call a biographical question for an author, you're all smart enough to know that authors make up stories about themselves and how they become an author. That's part of kind of what we do, and for me it's a little bit of a mystery, as you can hear. I'm not from Germany. I'm from Ireland. I grew up in Ireland. I had no connection to Germany whatsoever. I just found German history, the history of extremes in 20th century, to be really fascinating. So I was always interested in Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, fascist Italy. That was always, like, even as a teenager, it's a kind of sad dream as a teenager. You know, I want to be a historian when I grew up, but that was kind of me.
But you're aware of troubled times in Ireland
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, and so what I think now when I look back on that is I think that, you know, I was born in 1981, grew up in Dublin. 100 kilometres away from where I lived was the border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. My memories of that border as a child, a very strong memory of crossing it, soldier in the middle of the road, asking my father to get out of the car, inspecting the boot, you know, it was a military checkpoint. And I remember thinking, that soldier's on his own. What a horrible position to be in. And also I remember thinking his voice is completely different to the accents we'd hear on the BBC, because in Ireland everybody watches BBC, but obviously a squaddie doesn't talk like a guy on the BBC, or at least then didn't. And then you realise there's about 20 soldiers with guns in the bushes and they're all trailing your car. And you're a child and you're thinking about that. And I think that's what made me be interested in violence. You know, we were very close to violence in Dublin in my childhood, but very mentally very far away from it. And we constructed this mental boundary that made us realize, think it's okay that, you know, civilians are being killed, bombings are taking place, all within, you know, a drive away from where we live. But actually, we've created a mental map in our heads that allows us to think that is happening on the other side of the world. It's a very place that's very far away from me. And then I think myself, you know, as a teenager, I took an even further step away from that by saying I'm interested in violence, but not in the violence that's close to me, but the violence of the past. And that's probably my journey into becoming a historian. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how that worked. But that's why I'm fascinated with violence, and that's why I've been focusing on it, because in German history, in the 20th century, violence is the theme. Every single debate about Germany in the 20th century is a debate about violence. Everything that matters most is how did that country, and how did ordinary people in that country, people who could be like more or less the same as everybody in this room, how did Germany generate so much violence in the 20th century? And that's kind of my life's intellectual problem, trying to explain that. And at the moment, I'm staying in the antechamber, you know, the decade before Hitler comes to power. I teach the Holocaust. I understand the literature of it. I'm not yet maybe ready to research it because it's so intense, But I'm always trying to figure out, you know, what was happening, what insights can we get into how the Holocaust happened by studying Germany in the 20 years before it happened, right? So if you remember kind of one or two things from this lecture, one of the most important things to remember, the year 1942 is the year of the Holocaust. At the start of 1942, most victims of the Holocaust are still alive. At the end of 1942, that's no longer true. Most of the killing in the Holocaust, most of the mass murder takes place in the year 1942. And so my book on 1923 starts in the summer of 1922. It's only 20 years before that. Some of the younger people in the audience here will consider 20 years to be a very long time. Those of us who are a little bit older will recognize 20 years goes by in a flash. So how did Germany go from being the Germany of the summer of 1922 to being Germany of the year of the Holocaust of 1942? And that's one of the reasons why I start the book, and I'm jumping forward slightly, with the murder of Walter Rathenau, who was Germany's foreign minister. He was the only German Jew to hold the position of foreign minister in the 20th century. And he gets killed in a spectacular drive-by shooting by a group of right-wing terrorists in the summer of 1922. And that's the question is, how does that moment in history become 1942? Because what you might expect when we think about the weakness of Weimar and the rise of Nazism, we might expect that that would happen, that the Jewish foreign minister would be murdered by anti-Semites. We might expect that. What we probably don't expect is that the reaction to it in the summer of 1922 is that there are millions of mass demonstrations, perhaps as many as a million people, mobilized on the streets in Berlin alone to condemn the murderers. And so that paradox, that challenge is, how did that moment become what happened 20 years later? And that's the autobiographical or biographical question that I'm trying to answer in my work as a historian, and will continue to try and answer, you know, because the work is always ongoing.
Yeah. Tell us, perhaps thinking about the structure of the book, tell us a bit about what Germany was like in 1920. What was the sort of economic and social circumstances?
So I think one thing I want to, could we just jump the slide? One thing I want to sort of stress about Weimar just in a general level is these images are Otto Dix. And Otto Dix is probably the most famous artist from Weimar Germany. And it's because his art is so strikingly unique. The picture on the left is very famous, known as the War, and the right, the Großstadt, the big city. And so you can see this is 1920, 1927, 28. You see jazz music. You can see at the back, you can see a black musician. You can see social taboos being broken, the dress, the clothing, the short skirts, the morals being transcended in that picture. Here you can see the trauma of war. And if we just flick forward, this picture is much less well known, particularly in this part of the world. It's from 1930, the evening above Potsdam. And these two images, these artworks, Evening Above Potsdam and Otto Dix, really position Weimar Germany and its debates and questions about it in history. Weimar Germany is unique in that it's a post-war society. This comes back to the question that Richard just asked me, you know, what was it like in Germany in the 1920s? 2 million soldiers have been killed in the war. Every family knows somebody who's been killed in the war. 800,000 civilians have died as a result of starvation by something called the blockade. So one of the things that Britain leads in the First World War is a blockade of Germany to stop food imports to Germany from taking place, to weaken Germany's ability to fight. That reduces the amount of food and supply in Germany. It's not entirely the consequence of the war. The people starve. The German government also make a mess of distributing the food they have. So some towns have too much food in the war, some too few. But there's significant starvation and loss of life. So you have this post-war society which has to come to terms with that mobilization for war and the fact that Germany has lost the war. So that's one way of thinking about Weimar, this post-war society and this unique post-war society which becomes the stage upon which Hitler emerges as a veteran of that war, as the man who destroys German democracy. And that's a comforting story, I think, today, because we don't live in a post-war society right now. Okay, we do, in a way. Iraq, Afghanistan are wars that have happened. Britain today is a post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan society post-war, but it's not in the same way because the mobilization for those conflicts was not total. So that story comforts us because it suggests Weimar is a different place to our own world. Whereas this picture, which is the one I really want you to remember, Richard and I could be in this picture. Note the jacket. We didn't organize this before coming. You know?
I've had it for a few years.
Note the number of people who will be wearing trousers and a jacket and a shirt. That's the way a lot of men dress. Note the arms. You'll see women walking around Bradford today wearing a dress like that, especially if the sun stays out, right? So this is modern dress. These are modern subjects. This is the other way to think about Weimar Germany, a modern society facing into crisis. The despair on their faces, are the glass half empty, half full? You know, they're pretty obviously half empty. It's 1930. We know what's going to come next in this story. And what I want to stress to you when you think about Weimar Germany is, you know, can you recognize this picture? Have you sat around a dinner table or in a pub in the last 5 years or 10 years or in the last week and stared up at the sky and thought, what is going on in this country? What is going on in the world in which we live in? Is this a representation of a discussion you've been part of when you're talking about Brexit or you're talking about Boris Johnson or you're talking about whatever it is, the issue that annoys you about politics right now, or you're talking about the European Union, maybe if you're on the other side of that debate? This is the where are we going to moment in a discussion, in a conversation. And that's what links us to Weimar, because actually we are living in a modern moment of the world. For all the differences there are between then and now, we're still modern subjects too, and we're still facing into the question of modernity in crisis and what comes next. And when we think, you know, to come back to your question, when you said, you know, what's it like, we have to remember it's a post-war society that's reconstructing itself and coming to terms with defeat, which gives it something unique. For some, it's a land of opportunity, right? There's the dreamland of the armistice, a new republic, a new beginning, you know, a new democratic system. The old system is gone. In a way, maybe the parallel today would be, imagine if suddenly the class system in Britain disappeared overnight and you believed that had just happened and that had been your dream for your whole life, right? That's kind of what Weimar's like for those who wanted a republic in Germany in 1918, 1919. And what we need to remember is they are the majority. The majority in 1919 wants a republic, wants a democracy, wants a liberal democracy. In the first elections in January 1919, 75% of people vote for parties that want a liberal constitutional system of government, that want a republic. In 1932, at its end, more than 50% of people vote for parties that want the destruction of liberal democracy, be they the Communist Party on the one side or the Nazi Party on the other. Around 13 million vote directly for Hitler to be president of Germany in 1932 in what are free elections. So that's the puzzle of Weimar, is how do anti-democratic parties use the potential of democracy to destroy democracy from within. And where this book fits in that story is 1923 is the crisis year of Weimar democracy as it's remembered by those who remember it, because it's the year the Republic faces so many crises, be they hyperinflation, starvation, invasion. Hitler in November tries to seize power in Munich, yet the Republic survives. And so we've this kind of the justification, in other words, for writing a book about a single year, is that when we look at this year in detail, we see why the Republic survived. And that helps us better understand why it collapsed in 1932 and 1933, but it also tells us something that we're maybe not wanting to hear as much as we should, which is that if the Republic could have survived in 1923, it could have survived in 1932 and 1933 as well. And then we get the question as to why those stories ended in a different way. And so for me, telling the story of the year 1923 is about telling people today how those who were committed to maintaining the democratic system in Germany against a range of threats, international threats, lunatics like Hitler, all of those threats combined, how they managed to defeat them in 1923, because I think those lessons and parallels offer us some guidance. They don't offer us, like, you know, what to do next in politics today in the world in which we live in, but they do offer us some guidance for how we might do politics better.
One of the themes, I think, that develops here, and I'm sure will continue, is the way in which the right and the left were picking away at institutional structures and challenging and using language that threatened the Democratic Republic. Do you want to talk a bit about language?
Absolutely. So I think, as a kind of first point, language shapes politics. And what I've been sort of noticing and reading for this book and researching and thinking about it is how the language of politics changes in moments of crisis. And it doesn't just change what people think, but also changes how they think. And I think you can see that when you lower the microscope to look at specific times and places. And so one of the thinkers who I've been really fascinated by is a man named Viktor Klempner, who's mentioned in a lot of historical work on Nazi Germany. He's a Jew, he's married to a German, he survives the war thanks to the fact that he's got something called a privileged position in the Third Reich because of his wife being the so-called Aryan, which means that the regime, it ruins his life, it takes away his job, it restricts what he can do, he has to face all of the measures that Jews living in Nazi Germany have to. He describes the day he has to wear the star as the worst day of the 12 years of the Third Reich. He's not allowed to have a typewriter. This is an intellectual. He was a professor before he lost his job, or his job was taken away from him in 1933. He wasn't allowed to use the library. He faced all of those restrictions, and he secretly wrote notebooks about language and writing and reflecting on language as a form of propaganda. And what he says is that language was the most powerful form of Nazi propaganda. He says Hitler's speeches or Goebbels' speeches, they were not as effective as the way the Nazi regime, in his terms, poisoned people's minds by constantly repeating the same phrases again and again, so that even those people who were opposed to the regime gradually came about and started internalizing their phrases and their ideas. And within the same section of this memoir where he's writing about this, he even does it himself. He uses Nazi terminology in a couple of places. And even though he's aware of how powerful it is, it's still the poison is part of his own thought because he's been through this 12 years of listening to the regime's propaganda. I should, as a footnote, say, by the way, and this is a point that I like to make, is Klempner also survives because when the RAF firebombed Dresden, he is about to be deported, in other words, sent to his death. But because the firebombing of Dresden happens, he survives because he's able to flee the city as a refugee from Dresden. And his account of the bombing of Dresden is one of the best pieces of writing on the age of extremes, in my opinion, because he describes how the first raid starts and they're sheltering in the bunker, or the basement of their where they live, and then the second one, and then the third one. And he describes, the loss of life and the horror. And in the middle of it, there's a short sentence where he says, and I looked at the Gestapo building and I could see it was on fire. And in that moment, he knows the record that says there is a Jew whose name is Viktor Klempner in Dresden is being destroyed. And because that destruction of that record, he can then walk out of the city with only the clothes on his back, with his wife. They're both injured in the raid, by the way, and act as if they were not Jewish until the end of the war. So there's a footnote there when we think of the morality of certain events in the Second World War, that in this, I think what everyone would agree is a horrible air raid, horrible act of violence, which resulted in loss of life, of tremendous loss of life of civilians, but also saved his life and gave us this account of language. And so I've been trying to think about how does that language work in the 1920s too? What's its starting point? And so for that reason, the language of Nazism in 1922 and 23 is something I pay an awful lot of attention to in the book, because I'm extremely interested in how does Hitler work at the start of his career? How does his language work? Where does he get his ideas from? How does he develop as a speaker? And what has been probably most terrifying for me in terms of researching that and reading everything that Hitler has said publicly, for which we have a record at the start of his career, so that you don't have to, because it's not an enjoyable read. But what's striking about it is the extent to which he's being led by his audience. So, a term like November criminals, which is one of his most used phrases, he doesn't use it until quite late on. And when he first uses it, he gets a big cheer from the audience. And he realizes that's a slogan I can use. And so his speaking is very interactive. So he tests ideas, he tests sentences, he tests scapegoats. He tests the idea that he's going to say something about the Social Democrats in Berlin, the Jews in Munich, the Eastern Jews. We'll come back to that in a second, what that group term means. And the more heated the response he gets from the audience, the more he chooses to settle on that idea. In other words, Hitler's speech, although it has certain key themes which are present throughout his political career, in its early stages is evolving through a form of dynamism between speaker and audience. And when we think about that, and we think about parallels today, we can realize that there's a trial by language in populism too, in our contemporary world, whereby a populist speaker will wait for the response of the audience and then realize which slogans are getting me popularity, which are getting cheers, which are not. And so for all of their differences, somebody like Donald Trump and Hitler, and I always thought historians who compare Donald Trump to Hitler are clearly just looking for publicity and attention. I always thought that, right? And then when I was researching this book, I thought, oh, beep, there's a parallel here. There's a terrifying parallel here in that it's trials by language, that the language of the speaker is using words and seeing what words and what phrases will incite people, will get them angry. And every time that speaker takes to the stage, they're getting the chance to do that again, and they're learning from it. And the more time they spend on the stage, the more they learn how to mobilize basic forms of hatred, basic forms of racism. And that's what Hitler's doing in 1921, 1922, 23. It's really, really clear that he is leading and learning from this world of upheaval that gives him the chance to do this.
And one of the things that comes across very markedly, I thought, in the book was the language that's being used by Hitler and his compatriots is quite close to language we're familiar with now. I mean, for instance, make Germany great again is a sort of a phrase. Fake news, he goes in for fake news. He attacks the media. He uses labels for his enemies like November criminals, which are handy. And he feeds back in the book, if people attack him as loudmouths or anti-Semite, he uses that as a badge of honor. A bit like Trump used the language that Hillary Clinton used of deplorables. He uses loudmouths as a badge, or anti-Semite as a badge of honor. So there are kind of slightly unsettling... you wrote a piece recently about Gary Lineker. Tell us about Gary Lineker, or your views on Gary Lineker.
Yeah, I mean, well... So one of the things with the Gary Lineker, what would we call it, storm, the storm that emerged when Gary Lineker said this is like the language of Germany in the 1930s. One of the things that kind of, I'm glad you asked me, because one of the things that kind of annoyed me is as a historian who spent years and years and years researching and thinking about language, it was kind of annoying to watch that entire debate pass by in Britain and everybody interested in it with no historians contributing to it whatsoever. And so this kind of little like plea for like if we're going to make Britain great, greater again, if we're allowed to say that, bring experts back into the conversations because experts have a lot to share. And so, you know, Gary Lineker's both right in a sense. You know, this is language that has echoes of the past.
What was he speaking on particular?
He's speaking of the dehumanization of a group. So dehumanization of migrants. That is a pattern of language that's used in the 1930s, not just in the 1930s. Where I think Gary Lineker would do well would be if so in the piece I wrote for the Irish Independent was that it's not just the form of language, the content, but it's the form, it's the slogans, the constant repetition. So when Klempler is talking about how the poison of a certain kind of language gets into your head, that's what Gary Lineker should have used his position to highlight. So to highlight the way that the three-word slogan has become such an important part of contemporary language in Britain. So it started as, you know, get Brexit, going back even further, Brexit means Brexit, get Brexit done, stop the boats. These three-word, these mantras that are being hit, that is the form of political language of the 1930s and 1920s. That is the way that extreme right populists like Hitler or the kind of Alfred Hugenbergs, who are kind of like the Rupert Murdochs of the 1920s, and that they have press barons and they oppose the system and they, you know, use a lot of slogans. So that's what Gary Lineker got right. But what's important in terms of thinking about the difference between the language of Nazism in the 1920s and 1930s is that it was a much more violent language. It was a language calling for violence from its very beginnings. And in that sense, he got that wrong. And that's not his fault, because after all, his job is to talk about football in the media, not to be a historical expert. But when we look at Hitler from the very beginnings, the fantasy of violence is very much part of his work, his language from the very start. So in 1922-23, I describe what I would call Hitler's gallows moments. So when he's talking publicly, he talks about, we'll hang them. When we come to power, we'll hang them all. You know, that's a gallows moment where he talks about, you know, he's fantasizing about violence. He's calling on his audience to participate in a fantasy of violence. And then the question is, you know, to what extent are those linguistic fantasies, and to what extent are they starting points for what becomes the violence of the Holocaust when it's physically enacted? Looking at how contemporaries responded to that, you know, German Jews in 1922, 1923, 1924 are the best observers of what Hitler is up to at this time, because they know the threat he poses. Social Democrats are observing what he does. One of the heroes in the book, a man called Alvin Sanger, he's a social democrat in Munich. Munich itself is a city, it's a bit like Texas or Austin in Texas, in the state of Texas, you know, a small liberal island surrounded by a really conservative hinterland. And so there's a strong social democratic movement in the city of Munich, and he's one of the social democrats responding to Hitler's growth in popularity. Remember, at the start of 1923, Hitler has about 8,000 followers in the Nazi Party. At the end of the year, in November, just before his putsch, he has about 50,000. So it's his breakthrough year. And Sanger is responding to this, and he's going, look at this guy. Listen to what he says. The term he uses is, he's a psychopath. You know, it's very, very clear to observers like him and to observers from the German Jewish organizations the threat that Hitler poses through his language, through his constant calling for violence. On the eve of the putsch, when they try to seize power in Munich, one of Hitler's advisors has a constitutional document in his pocket, which is largely forgotten about. And this is what the constitution of the new state will be if we come to power. It includes the provision for the murder of everybody who has benefited from the Weimar Republic since the 8th of November 1918. In other words, there's a provision in it to murder every single pro-Republican politician in Germany at that time. It includes provision for measures against Jews, for mass violence against Jews. It includes the provision that any, in inverted commas, German who helps a Jew not comply with the new measures that the regime will introduce is to face the punishment of death. The punishment of death is like one of their mantras. This is extremely radical language from the very, very beginnings.
But can we go a little bit along the path where you started with, you know, 1923, a functioning democracy, a functioning judiciary, a free press, Hitler looking like a psychopath, very nearly gets killed in the putsch. A bullet misses him by 2 inches from his nose. Take us forward a bit and to your opening question. What are the steps that take us from there to the horrors of the 12 years of Nazi rule? What are the next stages that make it that shift move?
I mean, it's a huge question. So
sorry.
I think it's what's important is Hitler loses the putsch. You know, the putsch is a spectacular failure.
Tell people about the putsch, I think.
So the putsch, when it takes place on the 8th of November in Munich, it's too late, is the first thing. So there's a moment and a chance when the state could fail, and that's a few weeks earlier. And Hitler is too late in recognizing that this is the time for him. So his putsch is kind of doomed to fail before it starts. The important thing to note is the radical potential ideas that are in that constitutional document, what the putschists want if they win, is very much part of what they are about. And that's what makes it different to the language of politics today, which is where Lineker was wrong. But it lasts 20 hours, 15 people are killed in it, on the putschist side, 4 police, and 1 waiter who's shot in the crossfire. And so it's not that big an event in terms of its own historical context at the time. There are more violent events in Germany and German cities between 1918 and 1923 than the Hitler putsch. There are more violent events in Germany in 1923 than the Hitler putsch. There's a separatist riot in Dusseldorf in September, which is about equal in terms of loss of life. Nobody remembers the separatists because that movement never became anything. Whereas Hitler in 1933, once he comes to power, he has already created a cult around the putsch as being the founding moment of his movement. And so from 1933, Throughout the Third Reich, the putsch is reenacted, it's staged, it's celebrated. It is a part of the cult of National Socialism's version of its own history. So Hitler himself returns to Munich in 1933, reenacts the putsch. In 1935, they reenact the putsch on a spectacular scale. They exhume all of the bodies of the Nazis who are killed. They exhume the body of the waiter, and they now claim that he's also a Nazi because they want to have they want to have 16 coffins.
An even number.
We're staying in a kind of jovial way, but this is actually, they're deadly serious. They build a temple for these victims, their martyrs, in the center of Munich. They're not reburied. Their coffins are above the ground, and they want 8 on either side, so the temple looks more spectacular. Remember, you know, Hitler's always fantasized about being an architect, and that is part of how he enacts his power throughout the existence of the regime. So this is kind of very much Hitler, you know, it will appeal to him, and that is what they do. So it becomes part of, the putsch becomes part of the cult of Nazism. To come back to this really difficult question, so what happens from 1923? The Democrats win in 1923. Hitler is defeated. At the end of the year, the man we've been talking about that we're all interested in, you know, he is in a prison in Munich. He is depressed. He's talking about committing suicide. He is down. And one of the things we see throughout the year 1923, not just when he's defeated after the putsch, he also has a spectacular failure in May 1923. So in the start of May, Hitler wants to open fire upon a socialist demonstration in the city of Munich. And Hitler, from January, February, March, has been talking about violence. He's been inciting his followers. We're going to attack the left. And on the 1st of May, which is traditionally a workers' day, May Day, the left is marching through Munich. Hitler goes as far as getting his followers to assemble on a hill overlooking where the socialists are marching. They borrow artillery from the Reichswehr. Some of the German army units, in other words, some Bavarian army units, lend weapons to Hitler, but only for show. And so he's standing on in this open space zone. We're going to attack them. We're going to attack them. His followers are getting themselves into the state of emotion that men get into before they're about to kill or be killed. And then they have to hand the weapons back. So it's a massive damp squid. It's an extraordinary, humiliating moment for Hitler. And in that moment, we see what I would argue is his psychology as a leader fully formed. So we see the story we already know from the 1930s. He's humiliated. The stage is taken away from him. And he first goes into a bout of depression. He gets really angry, gets really down, and he leaves Munich. You know, like a child. I'm not playing with them. You know, I'm not staying in this city. They don't deserve me. And he goes then to Berchtesgaden, so to the mountain retreat that will become his mountain retreat for the duration of his rule in the Third Reich. And that's when he later says, that was when I fell in love with Berchtesgaden as a place. In 1923, what happens then is we get the kind of Hitler that we know from Downfall, in that scene where he's shouting and screaming abuse. He picks himself up and he re-engages, he remobilizes. And one of the ways he does this in 1923 is through the example of a German nationalist who's executed by the French in the Ruhr district for violently resisting the French occupation of the Ruhr. And in the summer of 1923, that picks Hitler up, and he uses that example, the example of a man named Leo Schlagatter, calls upon Germans, we need to follow the example of Schlagatter, we need to become a nation of Schlagatters. And this basically is the psychological pattern. That's one answer to the question, because that is what allows Hitler to be defeated, but to claim victory from a spectacular defeat, and to be more radical the next time. So each time a leader like Hitler, an ego like Hitler's, each time it gets burst by defeat, it comes back more radical. And that's one of the open questions about the mind of a dictator, the mind of an authoritarian politician, the mind of a populist politician. Their egos require a certain kind of following, and when those egos get burst, do they become more radical? So that's part of the story to our question of how does the language calling for hanging Jews in 1922 become the language of we're annihilating from the second half of 1941, 1942 onwards. And one of the answers to that question, I would argue, and I don't think Hitler biographers have done enough work on this, is that each time he suffers a humiliating setback, he comes back more radical. And what started as a speech act moves from being a speech act to becoming something that becomes a physical act. And just to make clear what I mean by that, you know, Hitler can stand up in 1923 and say, we're going to kill the Jews, we're going to execute 50,000 of them. His movement says this. When the putsch happens in those 20 hours that I've spoken about, they do go after Jews, but they don't execute any. So they have a couple of hours when Hitler's words could have been translated into physical acts of violence against Jews. And what's clear is that there's a willingness to target the Jews on the part of Hitler's followers. There's about 2,000 of them. So remember, it's called the beer hall putsch for a reason. They're in a beer hall. And at that night, at around midnight, the Nazis think they're in control of the city. Some of Hitler's followers leave the beer hall. And what do? You've been listening to a leader telling you to attack Jews all year. You know, they go and they go to the Jewish districts of Munich. They drag Jews out of their home. They beat up some of them. They clearly have an idea, this is what we're meant to do. But there's no organization behind it. There's no structure. There's no leadership. And in most cases, they just let the victims go. They leave them go. And in one or two cases, there's even, you know, humanitarian reasons. You know, it's an elder. They find a Jewish name in Germany, people have their names on their doorbells. They find a Jewish name. They go in. They're like, we're going to get the Jew. And then it's an old man who speaks the same language as them. And they're like, oh, well, you know, we'll leave this guy alone. Or they simply act like drunk men and they just move on to the next target.
But the next time around.
But a decade later, they have a much more programmatic leadership from above. And so what I'm trying to say here is that there's an element to which those speech acts inspire violence in an unorganized way in 1923. But from 1933 onwards, those speech acts inspire violence in an organized way, which is why it's much more deadly. And part of the explanation for that change from 1923 to 1933 on the side of the Nazis is that Hitler is becoming more and more becomes more radical every time he faces a humiliation or setback, because he's a very fragile ego and he cannot deal with any kind of defeat. And we know that because that's how the Third Reich ends. When the moment of defeat happens, he cannot live through it. He just can't face it. And his last words are, "The German people don't deserve me." You know, he's literally just presided over the worst months to be a German in the Second World War, and German casualties. It's from December 1944 onwards. January 45 is the worst month to be in the Wehrmacht. That's when Germany is losing millions of dead. And that's because Hitler can't face up to defeat at the end, and he wants them to fight into annihilation. And that's because of to bring back my hero from the story, because as Alan Sanger said, he really is a psychopath. That's one part of the answer to that question. I have to come back to the other answer, though, because we haven't talked about the stage. Weimar is the stage where Hitler can do this. And so then the other side of the question is, how does Weimar itself go from being the place that can defeat Hitler in 1923 to being the place that succumbs to him over a period of months in 1932 and 1933? And the answer that you will get if you're doing history in school is the world economic crisis hits Germany following the Wall Street crash in the autumn of 1929. In 1930, Germany faces an economic crisis. 6 million people become unemployed. Millions more face shortages. There is an economic destabilization that leads to a shift in votes. That's why the communists get so many votes. That's why the Nazis get so many votes.
I hope that's true, because I wrote that in an essay for myself at school once. So I hope that's true.
It's true, but it's not... It's not completely true. It's not a good enough answer. Apologize to your school teachers. And the reason for that is, in 1929, before the Wall Street crash happens, the Nazis start getting more votes. The graph through which they start to increase their votes is going upwards before the Wall Street crash happens. So it's about more than just economics. It's about the legitimacy of the Weimar Republic at 10 years old. Because the Constitution is introduced in August 1919. The day the Constitution is introduced, the 11th of August, is declared a public holiday. Remember, one of the things I really want everyone to remember is there are Democrats in Germany in the 1920s too. Some of them are really brave. They're fighting really hard. They're trying to establish the Republic. They're trying to give it symbols, language. You know, so one of the symbols they give it is the flag, the black, red, gold flag that is today the colors of Germany. That's a symbol of German liberalism. Goes back to 1848 when there's a liberal revolution. That's one of the 11th of August is declared Constitution Day. Time magazine calls it the German 4th of July. It's meant to be a celebration of the Constitution and of independence and of the existence of a republic. These Republicans are trying to deal with all of the problems. And it's hard to explain this to Americans, because you keep saying these Republicans and they're like, the Republicans are trying to save democracy. What the hell? You know, so they're trying to do that in from 1923 onwards, they see the crisis, they win it in 23, they're aware of all of the challenges. They are trying to purge police and judiciary and, you know, those old civil servants who were appointed under the Kaiserreich, who are loyal to the monarchy. They're trying to purge them and remove them from positions of influence and power. They're doing the things that make sense. They're even doing measures to, against anti-Semitism, although I don't think they do enough, to be honest. You know, it's really one of the saddest things you can read. I've mentioned this before. The German Jewish newspapers are saying, you know, what can we do to defeat racism in our against anti-Semitic racism in the 1920s? And their answer is, we need to invest more in education. You know, it's, you could take those lines straight out of those magazines and newspapers from the 1920s and use them today. What do we need to fight racism? More education. It's exactly the same language. So they're doing those things, but clearly, by the time the Republic is 10 years old, and a lot of people are taking stock on it and thinking about what has the Republic delivered, there's a sense that it hasn't delivered enough. And there's a sense that we have to try something else. And there's a sense, particularly in the middle class, and we know this because of the way the votes change. So people who are voting for a centre-right party or a centrist party or a moderate right-wing party are starting to shift towards Nazism. So we know what class it is that's losing its enthusiasm for the Republic. And they're looking back and saying, at 10 years old, this Republic hasn't delivered enough. And I think that's the crucial point to answer that question. And one of the other, sorry for you.
It was a big question.
One final, it was a difficult question. There's a reason your school exams are 3 hours. One final point to think about that is that the shift that happens at 10 is partially facilitated by what we would today call platforming, the platforming of Hitler. So Hitler in 23, at the end of the year 1923, Hitler's supposed to be a forgotten figure. The editorials, opinion writers, at the end of the year, New Year's message for the year 1924 is, we're never going to hear this guy again. The Social Democrats are even condescending in that, like, look at the far right in Germany. They're an absolute mess. You know, they're an absolute chaotic bunch of idiots. They all hate each other. None of them are going to be competent to ever come back and challenge us again. It's almost triumphalist. Within other sectors, the sectors that will come to vote for Hitler in the 1930s, they are, in the early 1930s, they're even looking at him and thinking that guy was trying to stage a coup with about 2,000 followers. It failed. He's not expected to return. In 1929, he gets platformed by a man named Alfred Hugenberg, who I've mentioned previously, who is one of the press barons. He's also a conservative politician. He's a rich businessman. He opposes the Republic. He's moderately anti-Semite. He opens his press to giving good publicity to Hitler, and they all join on one stage. And the stage they join on is a campaign for something called the Young Plan referendum. So they campaign for a referendum. The Young Plan, what was that? So at the end of the 1923 crisis, the United States re-engages with Europe. The United States, Britain, and France come to an agreement that Germany's economy will be stabilized through a set of American loans to Germany that are led by a committee of experts that's led by a man called Charles Dawes, and it's called the Dawes Plan, and it has a five-year time frame. Dawes is a banker. After 5 years in 1929, one of Dawes' associates, Owen Young, who's also an American businessman, American banker, is charged with drawing up the next version of the plan, the next version of loans. Remember, the Dawes plan has stabilized Germany. The reason there's a roaring 20s in Germany is because of the Dawes plan. It's the overarching, it facilitates economic stability. And the Weimar Constitution, because it's so forward-looking in 1919, includes the provision that you can have direct democracy, you can have a referendum. If you get enough people who are entitled to vote to sign a petition saying we want a referendum on this act, then there has to be a referendum. And so the right in Germany, led by Hugenberg, call for people to sign signatures for a referendum against the Young Plan. And to everybody on the political left, to their surprise, they get enough signatures and there has to be a Young Plan referendum. And in that campaign, calling for people to mobilize to sign the petition. You know, you can imagine the Daily Mail today, sign the petition, we need to sign this. You know, you need to go and sign it, it's your duty to sign it. And enough people sign it, and the referendum has to happen. And so what happens then is in that campaign, Hitler's on the same stage as Hugenberg, he's on the same stage as other responsible politicians, and he gets brought into the fold as being a respectable figure, no longer the figure that led the putsch, no longer the, to put it in simple terms, the idiot who tried to seize power in a beer hall in Munich in 1923. He's now respectable. To finish the story with the Jungplan referendum, the referendum takes place, and it's spectacularly defeated because in order for the referendum to have value, the quorum of votes, I think it's 60% of the electorate has to take part in it. And so the left simply says, don't turn up, don't vote. And so not enough people vote in the actual referendum for it to have any binding effects. But that campaign itself puts Hitler in a place by which in 1930, when the economic crisis hits, his trajectory is already rising again. So he's already, so if we do a counterfactual and say what would have happened to Hitler if the economic crisis didn't happen, he still would have got more votes in 1930, 31, 32. He wouldn't have gotten enough to overthrow the Republic, I think, but none of us can say with any certainty, but he was still, the trajectory was rising. Sorry, I've spoken too long.
No, it's all clear. I'd like to throw it open to a sort of general discussion, but before we do, can I invite you to read this final paragraph from the penultimate chapter, because I think that might also stimulate some discussion. If you could just read the paragraph.
Please,
the last,
So
the one I marked there.
Thank you. So today, the politics of the beer halls are still with us. The conventions and rallies of populist politicians and the digital beer halls of the present all bear some resemblance to Munich's beer halls in 1923. Just as the minorities that suffered at the hands of those radicalized by demagogues in 1923 deserved better protection by the state, today's minorities are deserving of protection from the digital warriors who inspire others to carry out their deeds now. When we think about Weimar's crisis here, it would be a political mistake if the crucial historical lesson went unheard. The politics of hatred can only function when violent and discriminatory speech acts go unpunished. Ultimately, politics in a democracy can only function when the system itself is respected and honoured.
Would anybody like to argue that the idea that today's political circumstances are anything like Germany in 1923?
You've heard a lot of words in the last, and it's just after lunch, so can I just show some more pictures? This is the stage, the view that Hitler would have had speaking in 1923 in the beer hall. What I want you to notice, you can't really see it there, in fact, is there's a lot of women in the picture. So it's not just angry men. These are mainly middle-class audience, both genders. This is the putsch itself. Who can recognize this person here with the glasses? It's not Goring, no. Sorry? Himmler. So this is the... This man will go on to lead the Holocaust. The architect of the Holocaust is Heinrich Himmler. Most of those are young men. Maybe the question we should be asking is, you know, how strong a punishment should they have faced? Was the mistake of Weimar's Democrats not that they celebrated their victory and that they were complacent, but that they didn't, you know, found their power on some kind of demonstration of state power against the right? Because they demonstrated state power against the left, the far left, against communists, against the Spartacists, against Rosa Luxemburg. You know, they were prepared to tolerate the assassination of Rosa Luxemburg. And some might even say the leaders of the New Republic ordered it. You know, we won't know that for certain. For those of you who don't know, Rosa Luxemburg is the revolutionary Marxist leftist leader who's executed on the 15th to 16th of January 1919. And there's an ongoing debate as to, you know, who knew what beforehand. It's another day's story, but the main point I would focus on that is even someone like Friedrich Ebert and the SPD, the moderates, they allowed the killers of Luxembourg to go free.
But you argue very strongly in the book that after the putsch, the authorities didn't throw the book at Hitler. He got off very lightly. And if they had thrown the book, you say, the history of the world might have been different. Is that right? Can that be right?
I mean, that would be one way of thinking about it is, you know, that's their mistake, and that actually, you know, when we think about history, and the reason I find history to be such a fascinating subject is, you know, it literally can come down to one moment in time that everything can hinge upon. Now, every historian will find something that they say everything hinges upon. But this really is a moment where you think, could Nazism have functioned without Hitler? You know, could Himmler have become Himmler if Hitler gets executed for treason in the months after the putsch? You know, what would Himmler have become? You know, that's these are the kind of questions where it really does depend on a small, you know, the role of chance in this history is really, really important. And, you know, that's, again, one of those questions which is both reassuring in a way for us today, because, as I've said, you know, there are very unique circumstances. We have the lessons of history with us. You know, we have the example of the past. So when we're thinking about optimistic reasons for, you know, we don't have to make the mistakes of modernity and crisis in the 1920s, because our crisis, whatever that we face today, you know, we have those examples, we have those scripts, and so we can do better. But we also need to remember as well that sometimes huge changes happen because of one small event, one leader taking too much prominence.
You were saying over lunch that you, the end of the book that you had intended, you changed the last paragraph. So you want to share with people what made you slightly rethink the ending?
So, yeah, this I shouldn't smile, actually. The book was just finished just before the invasion of the Ukraine took place. And obviously, you know, I wanted to end the book on a much more optimistic note, because in a way, and we haven't spoken today about international politics that much, but the crisis here in Weimar Germany is a crisis of the international system too. Yeah. The stage in which Hitler becomes Hitler, the year Hitler, 1923 is the year Hitler becomes a thing. That is part of an international crisis, a crisis of the international system. And so my initial parallel was to say, well, you know, at least today we can be optimistic that for whatever the differences in political positions between states and Europe are, we've found an institutional mechanisms that allow us to have those debates and to solve those problems diplomatically,
without
violent conflict. And we've left the era of imperial war behind us. And then, of course, doesn't Putin go and start an imperial war, which basically is a reminder that actually we haven't. Everybody has hindsight now. We can all see what our political leaders should have been doing with Putin in the last decade. We can all see that now. You know, you think back to July 2014. Who remembers what happened in July 2014? What specific event in July 2014? They shot down a civilian plane that took off in a European airport. And what was the response of Europe's leaders? Isn't that chilling? Isn't that, you know, can you imagine you were Putin that day and you get told, our guys have just shot down a KLM plane. Sorry, it wasn't KLM, it was a Malaysian airline plane. They've just shot down a plane from Europe. Do you think for one second he thought, uh-oh? And very quickly, it's hard not to imagine him just laughing. You know, they actually shot, you know, I always say to German audiences, what would have happened if that was a Lufthansa plane full of Germans? Germany, for those of you who know it, like the German Federal Republic has, you know, one of its founding events in terms of its reemergence as a power is the story of the Landeshut, which is a German plane that gets hijacked in the 1970s. And then it's the first time that the German special forces free their civilians in a special forces raid that involves them killing the terrorists. Footnote, the SAS were involved too, but the German media doesn't talk about that. That is the reaction. That is one of the ways, you know, the state demonstrates its power. You cannot mess with our civilians. And with the Malaysian Airlines plane, we literally said, you said you're sorry, fine, we'll buy more oil. Hindsight tells us now that was a colossal error, a colossal demonstration of weakness. You know, the timidity, and Obama comes out of this terribly, Obama and Merkel both come out of this absolutely terribly. You know, and I suppose if you think about what that says for the international system today and for lessons about democracy, and possibly one of the big challenges, I started talking about how I'm a historian of violence. You know, one of the challenges is, why was there no response to that act of violence? And the answer is because leaders like Merkel, Obama, Democrats, the European Union, and I don't want to say it in kind of using the language of weakness, but they're very restrained in the face of violence, because violence is always a bad thing. Whereas those who are their opponents and the opponents of this system, be they a Putin or going back to the 1920s, a far-right leader like Hitler, they've always glorified violence. They see violence as being something purifying, something attractive, something they have to participate in. something that makes you a real man to participate in it. And those clashes are the clashes that we see from history really clearly, and we can see them today happening again. You know, we're dealing with the legacy of the failure to respond with reciprocity. So we're dealing, we've seen that. You know, the international system has rules, and the fact that there was no backlash and no, you know, it's all well and good to stand up and say Europe has values, but if you don't defend those values when a plane gets shot down, then they're not worth anything. And thinking to the First World War, you can see how in the First World War, the parallels of violence against civilians was deemed unjustifiable. It's one of the reasons why people fought the First World War. I'll finish on this note, actually, unless there's questions, you know, because, you know, like lots of English towns, the First World War decimated communities here where we're speaking. And today, probably people in Britain, most people, when they think of the First World War, probably think lions led by donkeys. That's the stereotype people have. It was a war that wasn't worth fighting. Go back to 1914 and ask people why they fought, and they will say, we fought because we were defending ideals, defending Belgian civilians who were being murdered by German armies as they invaded in 1914. You know, they had an ideal that this is something that this world that we fight for is worth protecting. And without wanting to sound like a warmonger or, you know, a NATO cheerleader or anything along those lines, we do have to think, if democracy is worth protecting, in our place, in our local worlds, in our cultures, in our schools, in our cities and towns, and in the international level, we have to think again about how we do it. Because if we don't, we wake up with situations like the invasion of the Ukraine, where we realize we didn't see that one coming, when it was actually really obvious that it was coming. The response in 14 was, we can't react to something because we can provoke and escalate and make the situation worse. And that's the challenge, that's the question, that's the debate we have to have. I mean, to follow the other parallel that I think in discussions that has been very interesting is, like, you know, a strong democracy should be able to deal with a guy like Hitler, you know, without so much difficulty. And the other comment that comes up in a discussion can often be like, well, the populists today don't have private armies. You know, Hitler was a populist leader trying to destroy Weimar democracy with an armed following, with a private army. And so that's not the same case. Different in the United States to Britain. You know, we saw on the 6th of January, the march on the Capitol, we saw that those militias were heavily armed. They are heavily armed militias. They are in the style of the SA. In Britain, populist leaders, guys, you know, they do not have private armies. And so that is a difference. The worrying thing, and I can say this more about Ireland than I can about Britain, is, and similarly, the Irish far-right, populist right, don't have a private army, but they're able to set the agenda without one. Which is actually one of the things that makes the situation slightly more frightening for me, is that they're able to set an agenda without marching through the streets like paramilitaries. You know, there's absolutely no chance of Ireland joining NATO because you need to have conditions to be able to join NATO, and Ireland is so far away from being able to fulfil those that it's not possible. I mean, it would take a decade of investment to have military that would be in a position to be in NATO. Ireland achieves a lot for a very small state by being neutral. And that gives them a position to, like, you know, Ireland was on the Security Council of the UN. Does anyone know what country got annoyed because it didn't get onto the Security Council temporarily? Canada. Tiny little Ireland defeated Canada in the UN. How's that possible? Right? It's because of Ireland's ability to present itself, its diplomatic, the state's diplomacy's ability to present itself as a neutral country with the interests of the global south at its heart. Because we were a colony too once. You know, and that motivates people. But that's another day's subject we can talk in a minute.
I wish we could end on a really optimistic note, but I think we've got to end it.
The slightly optimistic note is, if you'd like to help spread knowledge of history, there are copies of the book available outside. And I would love it if, having come the whole way over to Bradford, I would love it if some people go home with one today.
You'd be signing them out there.
Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you for joining
Thank you all for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for listening. The 2024 Bradford Literature Festival starts on the 28th of June and runs for 10 days with a huge programme of events. From comedy to crime, music to memoirs. Head to bradfordlitfest.co.uk to book your tickets now.